Okay, so today is Thursday, May 11th at 10:48. I'm here, Adam. My name's Adam Yunus, and I'll be interviewing Esther Porish for our Gatherings Places class. So, Esther, first of all, do I have your permission to record this?
Yes, you do.
Okay, Esther. So, I'll be asking you some questions related to the history and your experiences at KINS. So, to begin, I'd like to learn a little bit about your father's role in Rogers Park and your familial history coming to Chicago.
Okay, so my father was the rabbi of Congregation Beth Shalom. It was located at 1233 West Pratt in Chicago. Unfortunately, it is no longer in existence. We came to Chicago in 1956. From High Point, North Carolina, where my father had a pulpit, and he came here. He came here so that his children could all attend Jewish schools for their education.
Had your family been in the United States for?
Most of my parents were born in the United States. My mother was born in Chicago. My father was born in Detroit. Their parents came from Russia, in the Russia area, White Russia. In the 19-teens and the 1920s.
Yeah.
My father was born in 1918 in Detroit, my mother in 1926 in Chicago, so they were here a long time.
Yeah.
My father got his ordination from the Hebrew Theological College here in
Chicago.
Now it's in Skokie, Illinois, then it was in Chicago. And his first pulpit was in Danville, Illinois, and then he took a pulpit in High Point, North Carolina, and that's where four of my siblings, myself and three other siblings, were born in High Point. And but he came to Chicago for his education for his children, for a more Jewish atmosphere.
Yeah.
And what else would you like?
Yeah, so I guess going off of that, so how did KINS and the Orthodox community, what role did that play in the 1950s, I guess, at the beginning time for you?
Okay, well, in the 1950s, I didn't have much to do.
Or 60s, I guess.
to do with it. But
growing up,
my class in school, and I went to Hillitor North Suburban Day School, and there were quite a few bar mitzvahs and a few bat mitzvahs that were here at Congregation KINS.
Yep.
At the time, this was a traditional synagogue, not an Orthodox one. The difference is the liturgy is the same, but in a traditional synagogue, men and women sat together.
Yes.
And this changed in the 90s, I think.
Yes.
And when the demographics changed, and
yeah,
the people who were of more of a traditional bent were moving out to the suburbs.
Yeah.
And the people who lived in the neighborhood, their children were basically going to Jewish day schools, not to public schools. So it was a different demographics, and Rabbi Matanky was approached when the membership at KINS was going down, and he was rabbi of a synagogue where the membership was growing, and he was approached to come over and basically save this location.
Okay. And that took place in the 1990s?
1990s.
Let me think.
Yeah, it was the 90s. And actually, I came over as a congregant.
Okay, yeah, so I'd like to hear about your experience with KINS growing up and then how it has changed.
Well, growing up, I lived in East Regis Park, so it wasn't quite the same, but my father knew and was a good friend with Rabbi Meshuloff, who was the rabbi at the time, and with Cantor Mendelsberg. They were all contemporaries. And like I said, I came here for some bar mitzvahs from members of my class.
Okay.
And that was basically my association with KINS as a youngster. I didn't have much to do with Congregation Kins until the Reverend Metanke became the rabbi here. And then that's when, this is where I, for many years, this is where I came to services. And 20 years ago, I started working here.
Yeah. So why did you choose to become more involved with Kins? And I guess what has kept you, what has been the attraction of the community to you? That's a big question. Or what is the role that's played?
I was offered the job, actually. I was working for Camp Mosheva in Skokie, in their office, and I was approached by Dr. Stephen Karish, who was the president of Kins at the time. And he said to me, if you need a job, if you're working there, why don't you work for Kins? And it, my first reaction was, no. having grown up in a synagogue, and my husband had had a pulpit in Morton Grove, I was a little leery about working for one.
Yeah.
But he came to me and I said okay, and I've been here ever since.
And could you talk about the role that you play in those 20 years? What is your job title or in general, what you feel like maybe you're...
I was basically, we called myself the office administrator because I did more than just, and I still do more than just answer the phones or enter data. I do have done and continue doing, I do bookkeeping, I do correspondence, I do a lot of human relation with anybody who calls, and you have to know, you have to be able to know who really needs the rabbi, and who really needs help, and who is just pushing your buttons.
And
you know, it's something you develop over years.
It's interesting.
We have a committee, I guess, for lack of better words, to help people make weddings, and it's for people with financial need, and all I do is refer people to the committee, and that's all my job is with that part. But they'll say, people have asked me, how do you know who to send? And I say, well, when I talk to them, I'm talking to a deer in the headlights. I think they don't. I hear something, and they're talking to me about A, and I say, oh no, they need that isn't what they need.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just experience, you just hear it in their voice, and you know there's something more. And I always say that a job of a synagogue or any house of worship, your job is people. And it's not just, you know, dollars and cents, although that comes into it, because without it, you can't survive. But your job is the people who call you. My mother died, my father's in the hospital.
Yeah.
I had a baby, but he's in ICU. You know, all kinds of questions, and I'm the one they talk to first. So you kind of have to know when to drop everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes all they need is somebody to talk to. I always tell them, you'll never cry alone, because if you need somebody to cry with, just call me.
Yeah.
Because they need people. Sometimes you just need to know that somebody's there to listen to you. On the other hand, you also have to know when there's somebody you have to call the police on. And yes, we do have those.
Yeah.
And you have to know when it's safety first. And there was one person who, you know, we told her, you walk into the building, I promise you, I will call 911. And she, you know, I'm sorry, she has problems. I don't have to put up with them.
Yeah.
So it's trying to figure out who is what in the pecking order. And hopefully, you know, you get it right most of the time. Like I said, it's. I would say 75% is just listening, because they're calling. Like I said, I had a baby. I need to plan for a circumcision.
Yeah.
But the baby's not well. So what do I do? And how do I plan for it? Or just, you know, congratulations, my son got engaged, and we're gonna have an engagement party. How do I rent a room to have the party there? And what's involved? And what's needed? So, you know, that's I'm the first line. I'm the one they talk to. I'm not necessarily the one who finalizes things. Or, you know, all contracts have to be seen by the board, other things. But I'm the one they talk to, and I'm the one who's explaining to them, you know, this is what we're doing, and this is what you need to do, and, you know, this is how much food you need to order. Believe it or not, sometimes people say, well, I'm having this party for, you know, 100 people. I don't know what to order.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been doing it for 20 years. I have a better understanding. And you've talked with people with all kinds of budgets. I tell people, everybody has a budget. I don't care if you are Rothschild.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a budget. It's just the size of your budget may change. So if your budget's $1 million, that's still, it's not $1,000,001.
Mm-hmm.
And if your budget is $1,000, it's just knowing what your budget is. I always thought, pick your budget. And then we work with it. We can work with your budget.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes I'll say, tell me what you want, I'll tell you what it'll, approximately what it'll cost you. And then you can see, is that in your budget? If you don't want to tell me your budget, and sometimes I'll say, okay, a caterer will tell you, they over-order, and I understand because they want the tables to look well, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's what you have to order. And people on a tighter budget, I'll say, you know, you need 5 dozen.
Yeah.
And a few other things, and you'll be fine. And like I said, it's I always tell them it's the money. If, you know, you just know your budget and stick with it. And it doesn't matter what type of party you're making. It could be a circumcision, it could be an engagement party, it could be a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. You all have a budget. So those are things that go through my desk.
Yeah. No, so it's an interesting role that you play as the kind of like that first arbiter of the community. So I have a question. Could you tell me about some of the most impactful people that you've met through your time in the congregation?
And besides the rabbi?
Besides, well, no, you can...
Rabbi Metanke is an international known rabbi.
Yeah.
He's a very dynamic personality. And it's amazing to watch what he does and how he does it, and to be a part of it.
What would be
whatever he might ask me to do. You know, sometimes it's helping he'll somebody, you know, type up these letters or you know, just whatever he might, you know, somebody's calling, can get ready for a meeting or, you know, but it's just to be sometimes just to be a part of it and to watch. You know, how he's gone from just being active in the community to being active worldwide.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yes, that's very. Today alone, I had a phone call from somebody who had watched a of interviews that Rabbi does on
mm-hmm.
Wednesdays, and he was like, oh my God, can I talk to the rabbi? And I told him how to get in touch with him. And, you know, it's like you get to be a little piece of it, which is very, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
There are members of our community, some of who would prefer to be anonymous, and I will respect that, who do things behind the scenes that have to be done and nobody sees. And whether it's financial or it's just doing the job, and they're greatly appreciated. And I think they appreciate the fact that I know that they're anonymous.
Yeah.
And you have to know who wants to, you know, it's okay to put my name on, who says no name. It's not why I'm giving, it's not why I'm doing. The president that hired me, Dr. Stephen Karish, is an amazing, amazing man. And I have known him for close to 50 years.
Wow.
Our children went to school together. We drove carpool together.
Yeah.
And he is just, the family name Karish is synonymous with community. Him, his children, they are just so amazing people. To be friends, to be able to call them friends is truly
yeah.
remarkable. And I'm very blessed to call him, his wife, his children, friends of ours and close friends. And they're examples for the community. Truly, truly examples. There are others who were part of the community when they're gone now. Excuse me. Mm. And you miss them.
Yeah.
And you miss their part in the community. The person who was the president when the congregation joined together, which was before I started working here, he actually was my principal. I taught Hebrew school, and he was the principal where I taught. And then he was very still on the board when I started to work for here. And he was such an integral part of the community. It was Mr. Bernard Meir and his wife, Marcia. They were very much a part of the community, and it hurts that they're gone.
Yeah.
There were others, some who we lost very, very young, and some, you know, everything's different. And it's, you miss them.
Yeah, sure. Oh, thank you. So I'd like to talk a little about the importance of maintaining Orthodox rituals and what meaning this gives to you, to your own faith, and your own view of the communities.
Well, I am an Orthodox Jew.
Yeah.
In many of the connotations, most of the connotations, I would say, that means I wouldn't know how to live life without it. It is who I am. It defines myself, my family, my community. God is a part of our lives. It's not a compartment.
Mm-hmm.
It is. And it's how we conduct ourselves, how we dress. You know, I cover my hair, as many Orthodox Jewish women do, with a sign of modesty. It's only married women. It's our clothing is more modest. I don't wear things above my elbow, next to the collarbone. Skirts below the knee, and no, we don't wear pants in public. Not that we would wear under a skirt, but you know, there's a reminder always of you're a small speck in the cosmos,
yeah.
And we are just here on God's whim, and we better take care of ourselves, and we respect. Who we are and why we're here, and who brought us here, and this is all part of being Orthodox.
Yeah.
That it's, you can't separate. It's impossible to separate our religion and how we practice our religion from anything else we do. And it's literally, I don't eat without making a blessing. I don't finish eating without making a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
My prayers during the day, the observance of the holidays, of the Sabbath, everything is just centered around God and our religion. I don't know quite else how to describe it.
Yeah.
It is. It gives great comfort.
Yeah.
Because you know it's not you. If you're wealthy, it's not you. If you're poor, it's not you. If you're healthy, it's not you. And
yeah.
If you've got troubles, it's not you. But you're never alone. It's not, woe is me, I can't get better. No, it's not that. It's just knowing that whatever has happened to you, God's part of it. And when my children were little, you know, how do you have a baby? I said, well, it takes three things. It takes a mommy, it takes a daddy, and it takes the Lord. I said, without all three pieces, nothing happens. And that's without God, nothing happens. So, I mean.
Do you feel connected to the past with these rituals?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
It's generations.
Yeah.
It's literally generations. We are very blessed in that my husband's family literally traces back their lineage centuries. Not decades, centuries. which is unusual. I mean, any, you know, but he happens to be blessed. My children just gave me for my birthday a family tree of myself, and my children, my grandchildren, and my great grandchildren. And because it's the core. Family is always the core. And this is again, it's and the saying on the family tree is in Hebrew, Elan Elan Ma Avarechecha. The tree. How are you blessing me? How am I blessing you? It's the hope that the next generation will live up to this generation. It's one builds on the other. It says, how do you get high? On the shoulder of giants. That's exactly. It's your generations before you. You wouldn't be who you are. You wouldn't be where you are if they weren't there. So, you know, so your parents and your grandparents, your great-grandparents, if you're lucky, if you knew them. This is how we talk about it. We talk about them, our generations. We talk about our generations, our previous ones.
Yeah.
They are, you know, a person's only dead if you never remember them, if you don't acknowledge them. They're alive for us. They're alive for us. There's a saying in Israel that you may have heard, and it is Shenit Matsara Lo Tipol. The Masada will never fall again. And if you know the story in Jewish history, is the time of the Romans, and it was a fortress in the Negev. And rather than be captured by the Romans, they all committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And they came up, I mean, and they showed, they left food, they left, and they showed that that isn't why they died. They died not to be taken, not to be made slaves. And not to be forced to be able to still serve God. And it is still a cry, and to us it's still alive. Now this happened in, 72? The year of 72. but to us it's still very much alive. We talk about the Inquisition in the 1400s. It's still alive.
Yeah.
Certainly the Holocaust is still alive. Generations are the building blocks of who we are, and they are still part of us.
Yeah, so thank you. That's going into a question about Holocaust memory. I was wondering, how does memory of the Holocaust occur at KINS or manifest itself at KINS, and especially for the Orthodox community, the meaning of the Holocaust?
Holocaust is a very difficult thing. We have been blessed, and I truly mean blessed, to have members who are survivors. If you haven't lived through it, you don't know what it is. And I am blessed that I never lived through it. And my family did not live through it. They were already in America. But I know many who did. And there's no comparison, and there's no way for us to understand what they lived through and how they lived through it and how they live today. All we can do is be there for them. It is obviously a very emotional, emotional thing. I mean, we lost 6 million people. And there was an interesting documentary called Paperclips. And it was about a school in Middle America who, as a project, they were learning about the Holocaust, and as a project, they started collecting paperclips. Because the number 6 million is really big, and there's no comprehension.
Yes.
So they started collecting paper clips. So they collected 6 million paper clips. And they actually put them, and they were able to get a hold of a cattle car.
Yeah.
It's a number that does not comprehend.
for
certain things, they get there and it's too big to understand.
Yeah.
But sometimes you know one person or one family. My daughter-in-law's family were survivors. And my son had the opportunity to go on a tour in Europe to some of the concentration camps. And he went to the Majdanek concentration camp where you didn't walk out.
Yeah.
And he walked in and he said the prayer for the dead. And he walked out. And he said, "Mari, I walked in and I walked out. It affected him to this day.
Yeah.
It, you can't comprehend because it's such inhumanity. It's such inhumanity that it's beyond comprehension because it's not something that we can.
You know, the mind rebels against.
Yeah, it's too much.
Yeah.
But to be able to do something like that, just something as simple as that, and say, "Mommy, I walked in and I walked out. Helpless to my. I walked in and I walked out." And I don't think it matters if you were Orthodox, if you're conservative, if you're Reform. The Holocaust burns within us because it was against all of us. And Hitler didn't care if you were Orthodox or if you were not. He didn't care if you were observant, if you were non-observant, if you kept kosher, if you didn't keep kosher, if you're three of your parents were not Jewish but one was. He didn't care. He just, it was, you see, I'm speechless.
No,
the Holocaust
yeah.
is a very, it's a very personal, I think it's a very personal situation for not just for the Jews. We're not the only ones who lost, but we take it very personal.
Yeah.
And it is not something we diminish, and as the years go by,
do you think it'll play?
Always. It's always. It will never go away. It will always be a part of us. There was a song that part of the verses are, "And when the last survivor fades away, who will remember?" The answer is God. He does not forget. So we're losing our, you know, these are survivors.
Yep.
These are in their 90s.
Yep.
These are, most of them are in their 80s and 90s. So we're, it's not a, you know, they won't be here forever. They, God bless Spielberg.
Yeah.
For,
show.
There's also an organization called Names Not Numbers.
Yes.
Where they do interviews of, it's actually students doing it, grammar schools, high schools, where they pick a survivor and they interview them. And the students actually learn how to do the filming, the editing, the interviewing, how to do the questions, and they put the whole thing in. So I've seen several.
Yeah.
And amazing. Because sometimes you're interviewing a grandfather and sometimes it's a stranger, but you know, it's we never, Masada, we never forget.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for talking about that. So
thanks for the tissues.
Yes, of course. Could you discuss one of your favorite lessons from the Torah, or a story?
Love your neighbor as yourself. Because if you treat people like you want to be treated, everybody would be treated well. That's a basic tenet of who we are.
So Esther, why do you keep coming back to Congregation Kids?
I work here.
Yep.
You know, it's a cornerstone of our community. As you know, the building itself, it's three quarters of a city block long, which that in itself makes it a cornerstone of the community. Our rabbi is so vibrant. Our congregants are growing. We have two locations now. We have three rabbis. It's showing that the community is vibrant.
Yeah.
And that in itself is a reason to come back.
Yeah. Is that how you felt over the past 10 years, that things have been growing? And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you feel, you know, it's kind of like nice to be a part of something that's
growing.
Exactly. You know, it it's better than the other way around.
Yeah.
But it's doing something you enjoy, and you feel that it's productive. It's not, you don't feel like you're a pencil pusher. You feel like you're doing something for the synagogue first, the community second, it can be very rewarding.
So where do you see the future of the congregation?
Oh, look, I see it growing.
Great.
I see it growing. Jewish Orthodox demographics are different from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
The fact that we can't drive on the Sabbath or the holidays means everything has to be walking distance. So your house of worship can't be more than a mile or two from where you live.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to keep communities together. Unlike the west side that was all apartments, the north side is all houses. So once you buy a house, there's stability. And if you drive through the neighborhood, you see some really big houses. These are families who have taken old houses and remodeled them and brought them, made them bigger and to fit their size family or their economic situation, and they help stabilize the neighborhood because you don't walk away from a house like that. That helps stabilize the neighborhood, and all the different Orthodox synagogues and all the other synagogues help stabilize the neighborhood, because if you keep your young people, you grow. And as long as there's growth, there's reason for being.
Yeah. So we've talked about most of the subjects that I wanted to touch on. Is there anything about the history of KINS or the role it plays in the community, or the role that you play?
Is there anything
that
about
that?
No, I think we've touched on it. You know, all the different aspects. I mean, a synagogue, a church, it doesn't really matter. It should be the core, the center of your community. It's what brings you together as a community. It brings you together with common interests and common beliefs, and it makes you a part of something, and that's very important, because no one's an island.
Yeah.
And if you
it's important to
if you don't. The people who are the loneliest are the people who haven't found a place to be a part of.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a widow, but you come to the synagogue, you have a community behind you. Or you're a widower, or you've never married, or you're moving to a new community and you don't know anybody, you don't have friends, but you make your friends by coming to the synagogue and meeting the rabbi and meeting other members and getting invited to their homes. And being part of the activities, and finding out where they send their children to school, and you're in the same school as my children, or finding out that there are other alternatives that you didn't know what would work for, you know, we're not a, a one-buggy town, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So you have opportunities for different types of schools to the best for your children. And it gives you a place to ground yourself.
Yeah. Is that the role that it's the Orthodox and it's throughout your life, not just Kim's? You think?
Well, like we said in the beginning, religion is the core, but and that's also family. Yeah. That they go hand in hand, and then the extension is your community, your synagogue, your schools. Those are.
And you were a teacher as well, so you played.
I was.
You've played all those, been in all those different roles.
Yes. It really does, you know, set you on a path. Like I said, here I have the Karishes, who we've been friends for close to 50 mm-hmm. years, and other members of the congregation as well.
Meaningful relation, yeah.
And it's just, you know, you meet because of your schools, because of your synagogues, your whatever, your houses of worship, and it really does help you through the foundation of your life. I can keep babbling, but it doesn't help.
No, I think that's a great note to end on it. So, Esther, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Conclude the interview.